Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We are launching a new series with you today called Voices from the Archives, from 16 years of our interviews, bringing you the most interesting interviews we can find. Today, with a great civil rights pioneer, distinguished historian, Dr. John Hope Franklin. His life exemplified the myriad changes in the struggles for civil rights in this 20th century. This interview took place on June 14th, 2006. Dr. Franklin died on March 25th, 2009. We talked to him that day about his book, Mirror to America, the autobiography of John Hope Franklin. When that interview concludes, we'll hear a segment from Just Words, our Peabody Award-winning series from the Center for Emerging Media. We'll hear the conversation with Jaquetta Lyles, who's a day laborer working at the downtown sports stadiums. Please stay with us right after this short break. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. It's really my great honor and privilege to talk about, introduce you to our guest this hour, one of America's leading intellectuals and one of America's greatest historians, a man who is now, was born in 1915, and he has written some of the seminal works in American history, Dr. John Hope Franklin, who is the James Duke Professor Emeritus of History at Duke University, was the chairman of the department at went from Howard University to chair of the department of Brooklyn College, the first African-American to head a department in a predominantly white school, went to the University of Chicago, has written some of the seminal works, in history in our world, one that caught me as a young man that I'll never forget, which was From Slavery to Freedom, A History of Negro Americans. It changed the course of thinking about American history. And he's just written so many other books that we'll talk about that and more during the course of the hour. And Dr. John Hope Franklin, welcome. Good
Thank
to have you in our studio.
Delighted to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And I was telling that story before we went on the air about that book, From Freedom to Slavery, how it changed my life.
Slavery to Freedom.
Yeah, Slavery to Freedom. I'm sorry, Slavery to Freedom. Sometimes it feels like the opposite, but when you – before we go back to where your life started and like that, I wonder when you think about how that one book kind of began to change our thinking about – the role and place of African-Americans in America. I mean, the unknown, forgotten, displaced, misplaced role. Do you ever kind of just reflect on that one book and think about what power it's had to kind of change the way we think about history?
I'm not inclined to think that way for more than one reason. One is that, you see, that From Slavery to Freedom came out at the right time, the propitious moment. There had been other histories before that time, histories of African Americans. Their point of view perhaps was not what my point of view was, but they were fairly comprehensive and fairly respectable. I think of one that was published in 1921 by Carter G. Woodson, called The Negro in Our History. Mm-hmm. It was a very respectable work. And Woodson was not a slouch. He founded the Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History, and he was a Harvard PhD, and very well read, very well spoken, and very versatile, and very deeply committed to revising American history. And so I'm reluctant to take the credit, much of which might be due to Dr. Woodson, whom I knew and who was most gracious and generous to me throughout his life until his death in 1950. Now, I have been persuaded by people who have observed me and who have read this history that you mentioned. I am persuaded that it might have had some impact. But you see, the impact was on people who didn't know much about anything else before that time. And if they had known Dr. Woodson or even George Washington Williams, who wrote a two-volume history of the Negro race in America
right.
in 1884, 1882, they might not give me as much credit as they're inclined to give me.
Now I wonder, you were born in 1915.
Right.
And grew up in Oklahoma, which we'll come to in a moment. But when you wrote Your early books. You wrote that book, From Slavery to Freedom, when you were 32 years old in the 1947.
Right.
So, and it was a huge work for a young man to write, for any person to write. And I wondered, when did your own eyes and intellectuality begin to open to the role of African Americans in American history? I mean, because it was a history that was kept not just from white Americans, from all of Americans.
Yes.
So when did that light start going off for you about the role of your own people in the history of our country and what that meant?
I think it was when I was an undergraduate student at Fisk University. Professor Theodore Currier, who was chairman of the department there and who was a white, young white man,
mm-hmm.
Was 32, by the way, when I went to Fisk. He did not know a great deal about African-American history. But he knew that there was a body of knowledge that ought to be explored. And it was he who suggested to me when I was an undergraduate, when I was really a junior, that I should work on a particular problem. He was intrigued by the fact that not all blacks were slaves. There were those who were free, even in the Civil War, in the period before the Civil War. And he suggested I work on that as a kind of term paper. You see, even then he had in mind that I should go to graduate school. And he thought I ought to have some research experience. And so he suggested I write on free Negroes in the antebellum South.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I wrote a paper. It gave me the opportunity not only to explore a subject, but to condition myself in the area of research. I had to go down to the Tennessee Historical Society and do the research. I was able to see original documents there, original sources. And it really challenged me and stimulated me and encouraged me to pursue subjects like this, to open up subjects that were not commonly studied. And so I began to realize then that there was something there that was missing from the run-of-the-mill, ordinary kind of history that we studied. And Free Negroes was one.
Mm-hmm.
Then I began to realize that slavery ought to be reexamined too, and that other periods in American history that had distorted the place of African Americans in that area and that period, I realized that it was very, very important that someone, namely me,
open that up.
Should open it up. Yes.
Now, you were born in Oklahoma in 1915, and the early part of your book talks about your parents. Your mother was going
right.
to teach, your father
a lawyer.
Was a lawyer. And that, what life was like for you then in 1915, 91 years ago, as a young man, young boy even, and when you were six, was just so different from the world we have today in many ways. And I'd like you to talk a bit about your parents.
Yes.
And the influence they had. It seems like where you wrote the book was that your mother had this huge influence on your life. Your father was in there, but didn't seem to be in there as deeply as your mother in terms of what you wrote. And I wonder about what your childhood was like between the two of them and how they influenced who you are now.
Yes. Well, one of the reasons that my mother had a greater influence on my life was, one, she was an enormously strong person, great independence of spirit and whatnot. Two, that my father was not always there. When I was 6 years old, he went to Oklahoma, to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to prepare a way for us, since, after all, the village in which I was born was not a place where he could make a decent living. There just were not enough people, not enough legal problems, and so forth. So he took off to Tulsa in February 1921, and we were to follow him in the summer. My mother was teaching, and it was in her classroom that I had learned to read and write. without her knowledge, as a matter of fact. I just sat there, and she was teaching the others to read and write, and she was babysitting me at the same time, but I had my pencil and paper, and I was
working. You absorbed it.
I was absorbing. I was doing everything she had the other kids doing. But then my daddy went off to Tulsa, and at the end of the school term in 1921, we were to join him there, my younger sister, Anne, and I and my mother were all to go to Tulsa. My father had done well in the 6 months that he'd been there, and he was now in a position to bring us there. And we were so excited about going. I can remember that as though it were yesterday, although it was more years ago, 8 or 5 years ago. But we were waiting for him literally on the 31st of May, and he didn't come. And he didn't come. And we were all packed. And I can't imagine that my mother would, I can't imagine what she felt, particularly when he didn't show. And secondly, when she learned that there had been a race riot in Tulsa and that there were many casualties.
Mostly black casualties.
Yes. And she wondered whether she had a husband and whether I had a father. And about 10 days or 2 weeks, which must have been extraordinarily agonizing for her, kids would we knew the thing. Something had gone wrong, but we weren't altogether clear on what it was, what the ramifications and implications of it might have been. And I look back and think of what my mother must have gone through. And she got a letter, though, from him about 2 weeks' time saying that he was well and he was unharmed, but that the house that he had purchased for us to live in, and all of, I mean, the office which he used, everything, had been leveled to the ground. First they looted, and then burned every place.
This was a white riot against black citizens.
A white riot against blacks.
Right.
And he said that he couldn't bring us to Tulsa then. It would be some time before he could.
Your father was a lawyer in the early part of the 20th century. Your mother was a school teacher. You end up yourself going to Harvard University as a graduate student, which we'll talk about in a minute. And there's a piece of the American legacy I always thought was missing, a story that was missing. And the story is of the old line black middle class in our world from the period of slavery in the 19th century to the 20th century. And obviously your family exudes that, and you come from that, and that I described to you what I always thought about it as if people really study the black middle class of the 19th century, early 20th century, is one of the most intellectually prepared and polite classes of people that America has ever given birth to. And I'm just curious about what your family was and where they came from and how your father became a lawyer and what the roots of your own family are.
Yes. I think here we're using middle class in a somewhat different way.
Yeah, in a very different way.
When we talk about the middle class today, or when we talk about the white middle class at any point. I say that because it seems to me that the thing that was so striking and so remarkable about that middle class is what they went through and how they experienced the kinds of intellectual and educational improvements that they did experience. When my mother went to college, and she did go to college, you see, she went to a college that was historically and predominantly black, I guess exclusively black, really, but where they were white teachers, and where the most civilized discourse and relationships that existed at places like that. The same thing with my father, who was a student at Roger Williams University, where he met my mother, and where later he went to Atlanta Baptist College, now Morehouse College. Mm-hmm. And it was there that he graduated. But once more, these were civilized communities. These were places where your color didn't matter nearly as much as what you were, who you were, how you acted, what you aspired to be, what you learned, and so forth. So that these people were middle class in the best sense of the term. They were not well-to-do, particularly. They might have had some kind of stable economic situation, but it was not extraordinary at all. What was extraordinary was the way in which they were trained and what their attitude was toward life, toward their fellows, toward all people. Because they'd been taught there that everybody was the same. That's the only place in American life in those years where people were taught that everybody was the same, mm-hmm. you see. And in that sense, they came away from institutions like that with an entirely different perspective on themselves, on life, on America, than young people did who went to other kinds of institutions. Young white people did from other kinds of institutions. And you see, that is one of the ways in which the great heritage of equality came down on one side and did not come down on the other side, you see. And there was always some sense of condescension, some sense of noblesse oblige, some sense that what we do for you people is done out of a sense of noblesse oblige. And that makes a difference. It made a difference in 1900. Mm-hmm. It makes a difference in 2006, you see. And one has to remember that.
My guest is Dr. John Hope Franklin. And Nicole in Reservoir Hill, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Franklin. It's such an honor to be able to speak with you. Mark, thank you for providing this forum.
My pleasure.
My question is, I'm of an age where my parents didn't struggle through the whole civil rights era. And my question is, how do we impart the importance of the African-American struggle in this country upon our current youth who are a couple of generations removed from that struggle? And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
I would like to observe that I don't think your children are two generations removed from the struggle. The struggle goes on. What we need to know, though, is we need to be immersed in the history of the whole period. And that's where people in this country simply are not. They don't have any understanding of appreciation for the period a century ago or two centuries ago, and therefore they lack perspective. They don't know how far they've come. They don't know how short the distance has been that they've traveled since, let's say, 1900 or 1950, as far as that's concerned. I'm of the opinion that what we need to do, perhaps more than anything else in this area, is to first immerse ourselves in the history of this country and of our place in this country's history, and then having that perspective and that amount, that knowledge, we then can impart it to people in the coming generations. You see, but what we cannot do is to find places for ourselves in this whole set unless we are completely committed to understanding where we've come from. And so I would suggest to you that the first things we need to do is to become absolutely conversant in our history. And with that, we can enjoy a perspective that makes it possible for us to transmit to coming generations in a very proper way exactly who they are, what they are, and where they've come from.
Thank you so much. Stan in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Stan.
Dr. Franklin, again, it's an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
My mentor at the University of Maryland was Sam Merrill. I know he was a friend of yours.
Yes, he is.
Dr. Merrill helped me get my first teaching job. I taught history at Howard University, actually. And the first thing I read was your book, From Slavery to Freedom. Because unfortunately, back in the 60s, I hadn't learned a great deal in graduate school about the history of African Americans. And this maybe relates to your last answer. To my dismay, I taught up until the mid-90s at a community college and then part-time at a four-year school in the Baltimore area. I had students, some, many of them coming from very good high schools, coming into my classes, who knew hardly more about African-American history than the students back in the 1960s or 70s. And that was my experience. I don't know if that's been yours. But in order to accomplish what you were just talking about, it would seem to me that there has to be a different way of teaching American history, and that the people who teach American history need to learn it differently, even to today, the kinds of perspectives that are necessary to understand the African-American experience and with the context of the American experience as well as other groups. Still doesn't exist.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. What I would suggest is that as we look at the field now, we ought to look at it not in terms so much of African American history as American history, mm-hmm. and put in United States history of the United States the role that everyone has played in that history. That's the way it ought to be. I fear that we run the risk of overemphasizing and distorting the United States history if we focus too much on African American history. But if we put it all together and see the relationship between African Americans and white Americans and Latin Americans and all the others, we'll get some balance there, some understanding of exactly what the roles were played by whom, and how this all added up to making this country one of the great places in the world to be.
You raised a really important point here, and before I launch back into the kind of your life a bit and the work you've done, but everything you're talking about symbolizes the work you've done in your life, obviously. Is it, you know, in the 1960s when Black studies first came to the fore, women's studies came to the fore during that same period, and Black History Month became instituted in America, Black History Week first, and then Black History Month. But it seems like we've come to a point now in America where we run the danger of segregating history once again, that you teach history, American history, but then you teach Black history. As opposed, I was thinking about this the other night. I was reading another history about African Americans in the American West by Katz. I was really looking at that book. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you look at that book and you realize that one third of all the drovers in the West who drove the cattle were Black. Mm-hmm. But if you saw an American movie or a movie about the West, you wouldn't know that was reality. Mm-hmm. So how do you – the importance of making history real is so critical to changing the consciousness, I think, of American people.
Not only would you not know that a third of them were Black, much more significant is that if you read a history of the United States, the Westward Movement or whatever, you still wouldn't know that.
Right.
It means that we must go back and rethink and rewrite not just Black history, but goodness knows we must rewrite the history of the United States. And we put all these things in their proper places. I argue that, and I have always said that a student had no business taking Black history as such unless and until he was well grounded in the history of the United States. Otherwise, he'll come away with a distorted picture. He couldn't help himself. Now, I would say that if you are going to study the history of this country, the best way to study it is to study it whole. And that's what I try to do in From Slavery to Freedom. It's not really about African Americans,
right,
as such. It's about all Americans. The emphasis there is on Black Americans, simply because there had not been any really strong focus on African Americans, and I was calling attention to the fact that they ought to be considered. Now that they are considered, I would like to see a course in American history where all of them are given their due, that is, their equal treatment.
Amen. My guest is Dr. John Hope Franklin. He has just written his autobiography, Mirror to America, the autobiography of Dr. John Hope Franklin. In your book, and let me go back and kind of, just for a second, almost say from the beginning to kind of the third of your book, where you start your autobiography. And the two things kind of struck me. I mean, one is you describe growing up in Oklahoma as a young man with a real kind of the viciousness of racism and segregation that mm-hmm. took place in your youth, and how that obviously molded who you are and your perception of the world. And B, taking that and also your transition from Fisk University to Harvard University as a PhD student in history, also almost unheard of for anybody Black in America to do, and how you kind of the juxtaposition of those two pieces of your life.
Well, as I said earlier, I was prepared by Professor Currier to approach history in a way that it made it possible for me to not to have any hang-ups or any difficult problems when I went to graduate school at Harvard. And frankly, I went there with no notion of being inferior,
mm-hmm.
With no idea that this was unusual or special. It was a next stage in my own development, a next normal stage in my own development. And when I went into the schools, into the classes there, I'd never been in a class with a white person before in my life. But I was not impressed or awed by that. I looked at them. They were just human beings. They were not. I saw no superiority.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, I had been there only a very short time before some students, knowing that I had a capacity to listen and to write at the same time, some students liked to sit by me to look at my notes since they could not listen and write at the same time the way I had learned to do it. So I said to myself, they're not all that unusual. They're just white, and that doesn't give them any special endowment or any special talent. And I took them in that way, and I didn't think that they could make grades any better than I could make. One of the problems I had was that coming at Harvard with no fellowship and no money except that $500 that Professor Currier had borrowed for me, I had to work. I had to work three jobs when I went to Harvard.
Which makes it clearly different than other students at Harvard University.
We'll come back
to that point. We come back as we talk with Dr. John Hope Franklin. He's just written his autobiography, Mirror to America. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. My guest this hour is Dr. John Hope Franklin, one of our great intellectual lights in America, who's written his autobiography at age 91, Mirror to America. He has written numerous books. He was, first of all, let me just reintroduce him. He taught at Howard University when he left Harvard. And he went from Howard University to Brooklyn College, where he was the chairman of the history department. From there, went to the University of Chicago, retired from there, and went to Duke University, where he just retired again, and has written some of the seminal works in American history. We're saying during the break, I said, I wonder what it was like for you as a young black man getting ready to go off to Harvard University, and the anticipation. You said you didn't have much anticipation, that you just accepted it as another piece, the next step in your life.
Yes, I did regard this as the next step in my life. The thing that really was extraordinary was the anxiety I had and the suspense, the fear that I had that I wouldn't get there.
Wouldn't get to Harvard.
Yes, wouldn't get to Harvard. It wasn't that I had any fear about being at Harvard. My fear was that I wouldn't get there.
Because of money.
But when the financial break came to me in the form of a loan from my mentor, Professor Currier, then my anxieties were over. I never had the slightest fear that I would not measure up. I didn't have it. Because it was a kind of confidence that my mother and my father both gave or put in me. It's a distinction between being full of conceit and full of confidence. The feeling that you can do what you're supposed to do. They never suggested to me that I was better than anybody else. But they always, all the time, told me I was as good as anybody else and that I could perform as well as anybody else. So I had no fear when I went to Harvard. Not the slightest fear. And I knew that I had to be disciplined, though, because I had to wash dishes for my evening meal, and I had to take shorthand for some of the work in the newsroom there, and I had also to take in typing of dissertations and term papers.
For other students.
Yes. So for other students. So that I was busy. As I look back on it, I'm shocked that I performed as well as I did under the circumstances where I had to work so much.
You even left Harvard for a brief period to go teach and make the money to pay back the people who had helped you, and then
came
back to Harvard on fellowship, so you didn't have to worry about that anymore when you returned.
I didn't have to worry about finances once I got back to Harvard. After being out for a year, I taught for a year, paid off my debts, and was able then to go back with a clear conscience and some money in my pocket from the fellowships.
When you reflect back on your life, and you did in this autobiography, from your roots in 1915, going to Harvard, chairing some of the great history departments in the United States in our universities, writing some of the seminal works, I think, in history in America. And you look at, you know, the President Clinton appointed you to run that commission to look at race in America. And we all talk about how far we've come, and we always talk about how far we have to go. But I'd just like you to talk for a minute about how you reflect on that, how you reflect on where we were from your time as a young boy to where we are now in America, and where you think we've come, where you think we have to go.
Well, I think we've come fairly far when it comes to individual treatment and individual achievements, accomplishments. I really think we've come very far. I don't think we've come very far when we think of group achievement or even group respect. Mm-hmm. It's not that I am a PhD from Harvard and a person who's written X number of books that I should be treated as a human being, but it's that I live in a country which ought to treat all human beings the same way. And I have ruminated in one place there in my autobiography of the kinds of studied insults that I've had since I've been 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and if you know, people say, well, they didn't know who you were. Well, that's the difference. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
They don't need to know who I am to treat me as they want to be treated. And we haven't got very far along that line. If they're going to pick you out and say, well, now that you have written these many books and have achieved this and that, we will treat you as we want to be treated. That's the worst kind of bigotry, it seems to me. You treat a person the way you want to be treated, not because he has achieved anything, but it's because he is a human being and deserves to be treated as other people, as you want you to be treated yourself, you see. So that I would hope that I would hope that in the near future that we would look at this very carefully and reach the conclusion that what we need to do is to think about equality and think about the basis for equality. Think about why you should treat people as equal human beings. It's because they're members of the human family for no other reason, but no other reason. And you can't wait to be treated well because you have amassed this fortune or you've amassed these number of degrees and all of that. You need to be treated that way because you breathe in and out like other human beings and that you are a human being. That's the one thing that should cause you to be deserving, and that's what we don't do.
How do you look at, and then we'll go back to the phones here, how do you look at what you've just described and think about what you accomplished from your beginnings and what many people accomplished with similar beginnings in the last 50, 60, 90 years in America, and where so many young African Americans find themselves today, especially I'm talking about the kids who live in poverty in the inner cities, who are kind of left out and left behind in many ways. And how you translate what you just said there, both in terms of social policy, but as importantly, it seems to me, in terms of what has to happen when for to be inculcated in young individuals from the inner city that I am as good and I can do this. I mean, that piece seems to be missing.
There are two things that are missing. What you just said about the young people, but what I can say about the older people and their inability to look young people in the eye or look at them as young human beings and say, these young people need a chance. They need to be treated the way I want to be treated. And that's not what happens. I've been in enough schools, for example, to know that that doesn't happen in our schools. For example, our schools are rapidly becoming resegregated,
mm-hmm.
even the ones that were desegregated. Many of them never did become desegregated, but many of those that have been desegregated are being resegregated. And that's true not only in the southern part of the United States, it's true in the northern part of the United States. Jonathan Kozol, in his recent book, Shame of the Nation, talks mm-hmm. about the resegregation of schools in New York City, in the South Bronx, and places like that. Well, I would hope that as a responsible nation, that we would do better by our young people regardless of race and give them an opportunity that they deserve. Now, to be sure, our young people, particularly our young black people, are not performing the way I would want them to perform or in the way that they should perform. But, you know, you can tell whether someone expects something of you. You can tell whether people expect you to perform at a certain level. And if you And if you are not expected to perform at a certain level, you might not be inspired to perform at a certain higher level. And therefore, if people are going to turn their backs on you, even in our schools, as they do, then what can be your response? Your response will be what our young black people, the way they are responding today. They've turned themselves away from our culture as well as our learning. They've created a life of their own, a culture of their own, not very productive, but it's theirs. And their aspirations are in, let's say, some form of music and some form of athletics. Only a small fraction of whom will ever realize anything in those areas. But they say to themselves, and I've had them say it to me, that this is as much as I would be expected to do under any circumstances. So I'll just do this and let the world pass me by. That, it seems to me, is one of the saddest tragedies in American life in 2006.
I concur completely. My guest is Dr. John Hope Franklin, one of the great intellectuals of our world today, who at 91 has written his autobiography, Mirror to America, the 20th Century Fight for Civil Rights, told in the first person singular by a preeminent African-American historian. And Marie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. This is an honor. Thank you for letting me talk.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to say with Mr. Hope, I think with the minority students in our society, they should have a little bit of history and genealogy taught at home first and see if they can inspire their children to be more interested in history, because we are a society, America, that is only interested, and this includes all the races, in the present and the future. And they are not too interested in the past because they don't think the past can offer them too much. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie.
Well, that's where they're wrong. we're all interested in the present and in the future. But we need to know that the present and the future rest firmly, solidly on the past. And if you don't know your history, if you don't know what your forebears have experienced, in the first place, you don't know where you are. You don't even know when you've achieved very much. How are you going to measure the distance from where your grandparents were to where you are unless you know what they went through and what they have experienced? And how are you going to know that this is a path you must take to improve on where they were if you don't know where they were? History is absolutely indispensable, not merely to appreciate fully what your forebears have gone through, but indispensable to know when you are moving away from where they were to a better life and a better experience. So that I hate, and it's not because I'm a historian. It's because I think that that's the only way to go in order to move forward.
One curious thing, just a little personal thing that was in your book, that you have your orchids.
Yes.
There's one named after you and one named after your wife.
Right.
And the way you describe the two of them, this very delicate yellow flower, named after your wife, and this kind of rangy, almost wild one named after you.
Yeah. Well, my orchids, the orchid name for me, have gone through two lives. the Phalaenopsis John Hope Franklin, which was created in 1976 and approved by the Royal Horticultural Society in London that year, has become extinct, officially extinct. And the last ones died in my greenhouse 2000, one when we had the enormous ice storm, which cut off the power everywhere. And I had maybe 15 or 20, but they all died. And then the greenhouse, the Orchid Company in Dundee, Illinois, that had created that first orchid and registered in my name, and then created a second orchid, quite different from the first. Lelio Catalia, John Hope Franklin. That was larger and more rangy, as you might have, as you imply, than the first one, and it is still flourishing.
That's good, as you are. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you in our studios.
Thank you.
Welcome to Just Words, the stories of working people in our community. Have you ever driven by a convenience store in the morning and seen groups of people standing on a corner waiting for work? What about the people at the sports stadiums who sweep floors, clean bathrooms, and park cars? Have you ever wondered who they are? Jaquetta Lyles is one of them, a mother of four, a day laborer, who works at the downtown sports stadiums. She's paid $7 an hour while working, but she's not paid for the hours while she waits every day to see if she can get work.
This was my first year working with down there, and I enjoyed it at first. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And then as I start, you know, seeing how things was going, I really wasn't liking the way I was being, things was being done. It's rough. I clean, and you just get two bathrooms. Keep them clean and keep the little area between one bathroom and the other swept up. You go in there, you clean. I can just go right in, clean my outside area. As soon as I go back in, trash can could be there. Trash right there on the floor. Trash in the stalls. It's like really getting no respect. We really work hard. We only making like just a little above minimum wage. We're just making a little bit of money. They don't see to give us like a little $5 food voucher or nothing for us to eat. And if someone was to give us food, we get terminated. The food prices, you can't bring your lunch every day. You can't afford to buy the food there. I mean, that's like $5, $6 for just like a hot dog or something, you know.
Jaquetta is only paid $7 an hour, but not by paycheck. Instead, the temp agency pays her with a money card. She gets charged every time she uses it at an ATM. What would be a one-time check cashing fee is turned into something much more complicated.
They give us a money card, so you go to the bank machine and use it. It's $1.50 to get your money off. But if you use the wrong pin, they're going to take that $1.50 out of your card, and you're still not getting no money. They're going to take another $1.50 off from calling the bank card. I thought it was cool at first, but then when I started trying to activate and use it and realized then, hey, I started out with this amount, and then I'm like, shh. And then I have my friend, he works for them too. Shoot, every time he tried to use his card and mess up, shoot, he always left with like $29 or $20, if that much. Then he had $20 on his card and he couldn't get the $20 off because it's $1.50 surcharge.
Jaquetta is struggling, but she's hopeful and optimistic. Her desires aren't extravagant. She wants decent money and a little respect.
Everyone deserves the same rights and respect that other people do. But we should be paid enough to show that, hey, this person is struggling. They have a life, too. They deserve to live, too.
She's dependent on her mother to help take care of her children and knows that without her mother's help, she would be in a very different place.
The grace of God and my mom's helping me. Usually, they're in school. I used to get home like a half hour after they get out. But when I work at evenings, she comes home for like a little after I leave for work, so she's here for the night. So. If this wasn't here, I guess I'd be in some shelter hoping that I'd get something. I had a little place, a low-income place and stuff, but they got new management and they wanted to, from the little $100 I was paying a month, all of a sudden when they put the new carpet down, the new food things and stuff went up to $300 a month, so I had to come back here. So if this wasn't here, I'd be in somebody's shelter, and they'll probably find me a low-income place until they want to remodel or change or renovate. But I'm doing what I can. Yeah, that question is something I need to think about a lot more, too.
How do you maintain a sense of love and joy when the head of the house is so burdened with work and money worries? As we spoke, Joqueta's 8-year-old daughter, Briante, played. She's a happy, bright child who beat cancer when she was 18 months old. Joqueta refers to her as her miracle baby, and she seems to have been untouched by the concerns that plague her mother.
I talk to her, trying to understand. She'll ask me, now you get a paycheck? You didn't get that much this time. I do what I can. Every so often, at least once out of the month, I take them skating. We have all right time. We just sit in the house and play cards and play games.
Most of the people you work with also have kids, families?
Yeah, a lot of them have families. They do, and they struggling. But they doing what they got to do, and they just got to take it. 7 hours or not, you got to take that job.
Your only right now is basically bringing home...
Basically, really nothing. All told, I mean, $100 here, $200. I've just been basically going from... Just doing temp work. Where I can. But say I was on social service, so that's what kind of had me put me where I'm at. They wanted me to work, got me the job, and I was bringing home, I could say, two something a month from the work that they gave me. And they just cut me off totally. But I help, I do as much as I can. I work any time somebody call me, I'll go to work. I'll do whatever I can to help my mother because she got with me. Just keep on, keep on, keeping on. I just want to be, get what I deserve and should be able to. Just if you can't get on top, just kind of maintain. I enjoy being down Camden Yards because I like the people and stuff. Outside of that, I mean, just working with the middleman, the agencies, and before you finally get your pay from whatever money they done hired you out for, it done got cut down to so much by the time you get it.
Who are these middlemen? Joqueta is hired each day by a temp agency, one of two temp agencies, hired by a facilities management firm that handles staffing at the stadiums. The facilities management company was hired by the State Stadium Authority. That's three private companies, each making a profit before Joqueta gets paid. She has recently become a member of the United Workers Association, which seeks to eliminate the role of the temp agencies by creating a workers' cooperative, resulting in higher wages for the workers.
They came out asking us about the wages and how we're being treated, make sure we, if we have any problems with getting in, working, you know, so there's something kind of give when you get there and be there on time, then people, it's been people that have been there since 1:30, hang out downtown all day to make sure that they get to work that day. And then by the time I get down there, then he's like, we got enough people. I spent $350 to get downtown and got to go right back home and hoping that I get back out the next day. But that's how I met over there and I stuck going to the meetings and I like everything I heard. You know, that actually cares about the things you're going through. Care that you're working, busting your tail, trying to work and earn just something. And you find out, hey, damn, you working for nothing, basically. So I was interested, so I just kept coming back.
What for you is a living wage?
Nine. Anything nine, because I've had jobs, that, and that still really wasn't much money, but it was enough to help me that I could do what I want and still did things for my children.
Do the math. If Joqueta worked a 40-hour week, making $9 an hour, she'd make $18,720 before taxes. It's hard to imagine how she would support four children on that, but it's clear that her involvement in organizing with the UWA has awakened something inside her that is demanding a better life.
Everyone deserves to be able to eat. I've listened to everything with the UWA, and I really believe in it. And we'd like to see the day when somebody actually hears us, understand what we're working for and try to, like, just stand behind us and give us the support we need so it just don't be just the little men trying to fight for something. And we have some big voices, some big people standing up and saying, hey, let's hear them out. Back us up and be there.
Some of us were born on the bottom. We lived on the bottom. We grew up from the bottom.
The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. Our editor is Andrew Epig. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again or podcast any of our past shows or hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.